war in South Africa, an even greater disappointment. Clamoring that the struggle against apartheid had been fought to achieve human dignity and freedom from state torture and the economic justice outcomes of publicly funded water, electricity, and housing, activist social movements and shack dwellers have been met with the strange, even perverse accusation that they somehow are not holding up their end of the bargain. Indeed, poor people in South Africa and those most motivated to enforce the economic rights that are guaranteed in the new constitution have been accused of failing to meet their responsibilities as devoted citizens to pay for local governance. In my research, I examine this context of a distorted project of new and radical nation building and the reinforcement of what are really 19th century bourgeois contract theory ideas about the supposed responsibilities of the newly freed people to those who had allegedly granted them their freedom, right? The poor don't owe the rich anything. Mm-hmm. I said it.
Mm-hmm.
Such a reintroduction of ideologies about beautiful and responsible citizens might be best described in the terms used by scholar Saidiya Hartman as the, quote, afterlife of slavery, or in this case, the afterlife of apartheid. Such responsibilities, if they can be assigned, would readily be taken on if the new nation that the poor also fought to imagine and fought to live up to had also honored its promises. So I'm trying to study the associational life and livelihood strategies of Black women migrants and their capacities for pooling resources and protesting against unjust social welfare ideologies, which reinforce myths about them being good-for-nothing husbands and aunties who expect a pension handout. As Oberlin historian Pamela Brooks explains, quote, by direct observation of the social and economic strategies of the women in their own communities, we can see how activists of this generation were empowered to take responsibility for leading their own political struggles, learned by example the values, the behaviors, the worldviews that contributed to a growing awareness of the injustices they faced and the means with which to overcome them, end quote. It is in the associational life of the Black women migrants who socialized their migrant sons, husbands, daughters, both in rural and urban areas, that brought coherence to a set of ethical economic agreements which came to life through national and local public policy and resistance to that disastrous public policy in the bad old days of apartheid and in the lingering apartheid at present. Historically, the wealth generated through Black women's productive and reproductive capacity has been directed away from these women themselves, and yet they managed to reframe and reassert an ethical set of propositions about wealth and pooling of resources in the face of each new elaboration of the origin story of capital. In the 1960s, capital's mythology in South Africa claimed to be protecting the racially prescribed backwardness of Black women by restricting their economic lives to the reserves. By the 2000s, South African finance capital has remade itself as a so-called champion of green environmental standards by disconnecting public access to poor people's water, electricity on the one hand, and by undermining their local commitments to sustainable ecology and autonomous livelihood strategies in favor of things like new mining ventures. As political economist Jackie Dugard explains, cities have implemented neoliberal pro-growth development schemes to compensate for state-mandated but unfunded principles like the free basic water policy.
There's some free water.
The free basic water policy was a central platform in the reconstruction and development plan agenda at the end of apartheid. Indeed, one might describe apartheid as having been a racial economic system in which public services and infrastructure came to be aligned solely with the white minority, though paid for with the taxes, fines, fees, and the lowest wages imaginable, and the outright robbery of the black members of the society. So when the same parliament at the end of apartheid actually agreed to a free basic water principle, but then later decided that municipal government administration could use the payment of that water as a revenue stream for political parties other than the African National Congress, that parliament was engaging with a disastrous dance with the apartheid past, affirming that afterlife of apartheid, or what Julian Cooney has described emphatically as apartheid being not dead. Having secured an institutional power base, South Africa's political parties now face increasingly hostile electorates, which had expected that the principle of free basic water would be implemented via a justice-oriented pricing policy, which would require the largest water consumers, firms, mines, farms, and luxury residential households to subsidize the cost of water for the poor. Because as we might imagine, the cost and the price of industrial water is actually cheaper than the cost of water for people who live in shacks. Literally, as large volume consumers of water use more water, their price goes down. By treating water delivery as a commodity that poor people must pay for and pay for dearly, and by letting international private water companies compete for contracts to deliver city water, government and political parties have become guilty of perpetuating an arrangement of hyper-extraction of fees from the black poor, fees that benefit other groups and disadvantage them, which is a classic feature of apartheid. The city of Johannesburg perfected this strategy of limiting water access through the installation of prepayment water meters, it's sort of like prepaid cell phones, which were marketed as a city-led water conservation project. In the wealthier parts of Johannesburg, where conventional water meters exist, standing policies make it nearly impossible to disconnect wealthy people from water. Indeed, Johannesburg's wealthier residents are extended credit to cover the expense of water. This is not the case in the poorest areas of Johannesburg, where people must reload their prepaid water meter cards with credit because they shut off immediately when the credit is exhausted. Dugard explains, at the municipal level, this has meant that almost as fast as poor households are connected to the water grid in terms of the extension of infrastructure, pipes, and a tap, you know, into the household, they are disconnected because they cannot pay the monthly water bill, end quote. This so-called green innovation, launched only in the poorer areas, undermined the constitutional guarantee of free basic water, and had a disproportionately and uniformly negative impact on poor people. In a city whose mansions usually have swimming pools, Dugard suggests the violation of the post-apartheid economic justice agenda could hardly be more stark. The residents of the Johannesburg district, PIRI, along with the Socialist Anti-Privatization Forum and the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, launched in early 2000s a large-scale direct action protest during the actual installation of the prepayment meter system. And they filed a legal case known as the Mazibuko Water Rights Case. That's M-A-Z-I-B-U-K-O, the Mazibuko Water Rights Case, following the militant and discerning leadership of an unemployed single black mother. On March 17, 2004, Lindiwe Mazibuko, an unemployed single mother living with 20 other people in informal housing, was approached by a city water worker who lied and told her that her old water pipes were a hazard and needed to be removed. This person did not mention that the main work being done was actually to install a prepayment meter. Later that day, when Ms. Mazabuco found out that the sole task of the city workers was to install prepayment meters, she told them she would never accept these meters. From the end of March 2004 to October 2004, her water was disconnected, end quote. Like others in Peary, when Ms. Mazabuco agreed to the installation of the prepayment meter, her water was connected. Of course, we have to remember that the free basic water allotment of 6 kiloliters per month runs out for most people in urban areas in South Africa far before the month ends. People have to choose between bathing and flushing toilets, having enough water to stop the spread of fire, or enough water to cleanse themselves and keep healthy. Residents protested using direct action and physical resistance despite arrests, fines, intimidation, and threats. When they took the city water company to court, initially they received a judgment in their favor, which was unfortunately eventually overturned by the Constitutional Court in 2009. Women like Lindiwe Mazabuco come from somewhere. They are raised in maiden communities that have a century of negotiating with and surviving the starvation and theft that has accompanied making South Africa the wealthy industrial envy of the world. In the next section, I describe some of the many ways since the 1990s that historians and creative writers have sought to remember the people and ethics that created the Lindiwe Mazabucos. This next section is called Women's Assemblies, Mutual Obligation, Reciprocity, and Militant Motherhood. Injabulo Ndebele is the cry of Winnie Mandela, Loretta Lobos, and They Didn't Die, and Sindiwe Magona's To My Children's Children offer three written representations of rural and urban South African women's political organizing against and in the context of the migrant labor system. In particular, these works examine women's assemblies, norms of mutual obligation and reciprocity, and militant motherhood as means by which Black women intervened in the structure of involuntary migration and the construction of rural and urban spaces from the 1930s to the 1980s. In these three classics, we meet Black female protagonists whose lives are deeply shaped and made by the politics of migration, laws, passes, arbitrary local and national taxes and fees, which criminalized Black women in particular, and guaranteed that their presence in South African society and their aspirations for decision-making over their own lives and the lives of their children were constrained and restricted. Known by many names, women's associations, sometimes referred to as prayer unions or ibandlas, were central to the associational life of rearing and gendering females as protesting women. These weekly religio-political meeting spaces were a critical site for intergenerational education and politicization. Additionally, women organized rotating credit associations and burial societies across the supposedly polar geography of rural, migrant, city dweller. And they use this kind of associations to navigate gendered hardships. Such women's associations as forms of non-paid reproductive and social labor, and what Oyiranke Oyewumi calls social matriarchy, created continuities across these material and social realities of rural, migrant, and city dweller. These kinds of associations buffered and mobilized family members, spouses, children, and elders that depended on working women's livelihood strategies. Remembering the ways in which these women's associations politicized African women so they could reject the label of being merely abandoned reproducers of reserve labor is important, most notably because this remembering points to the ways that racial capitalism continually devalues critical reproductive livelihood strategies in order to more effectively starve people. Indeed, these abandoned black women and their particular vulnerabilities were central to the economic dynamism of industrial South Africa and to racial capitalism globally. Their capacity to create new survival strategies in the midst of one of the most aggressive forms of racial capitalism guaranteed economic survival for their families, but paradoxically also constituted a means by which even greater wealth could be skimmed from the black community. Women's religious assemblies, burial societies, and rotating credit associations provided and still provide long-term ties to rural sending communities. They provided alternative geographies of meaning and place for women and allowed them to survive the volatility and misery of unemployment and economic precarity. The religious associations, seen as a place for women to literally pray, mourn, cry, and build strength for another day, are examined in Mogo's writing, especially because they provided the site for political mobilization. In Ebongla's, women created a space to express their feelings about and to raise their consciousness about their role in the South African economy. Ebongla's and the cross-generational wisdom shared in them enabled South African women to regard themselves as more than the mobile nurseries for the next generation of dominated black workers. For women whose lives were so powerfully intertwined with labor migrancy, Ebongla's, and it's interesting because these prayer unions are often marked as being Christian associations, missionary associations for women, but they also, in the earlier scholarship from the 70s, are often paired with traditional diviners healing schools mm-hmm. that, again, were only for women. So these two kinds of sites of women-only spaces are places where females come to understand themselves as women, right, and having sort of an exceptional role in the society. But for women who were so powerfully intertwined with labor migrancy, Ebongla's and diviners training schools that paralleled them, these sites remain important places for teaching people how to survive. So how were women actually positioned in labor migrancy? Well, in a range of ways. Women who resided in rural areas oftentimes had relatives working in the cities. That's the first way. The second way is that women who worked in the city often had family in the rural areas, and they were sending remittances back to them. And then there were also women who resided in the urban areas who worked some kind of way in the informal economy, and they had a meager, like a very contingent right to live in urban areas because they were dependents of male relatives. So they resided in the shanty towns, bathroom sheds, and sometimes, but not often, informal housing. The people who excluded and excluded them, sorry, I'm gonna skip on. Okay. Lowell explained that this rural community's militant political action against passes emerged from the women's assembly. Emotional comfort and nurturance aside, the goal of such organizations was never merely to keep body and soul alive, but it was actually to alert other people to one's misery and thereby find solutions to immediate problems. We can think of them as kind of consciousness-raising groups. Yeah. Rather, the Women's Assembly was always a place where oaths and political commitments were taken, and where news of what women and men were doing around the country and region were doing could be shared, debated, and discussed without the state's eyes on people's actions. For Novo, this religio-political forum built women's capacity to launch strikes against forced sale of their cattle, prohibitions against black women's manufacture and sale of beer, and a site to be able to mobilize actions, and often militant actions, against local white bureaucratic humiliation and manipulation. In addition to the women's assemblies, though, there were other features of the survival strategies of black women, including principles of mutual obligation and reciprocity. Sindhiwe Mogonas to my children's children begins with an abiding concern with impressing upon her future grandchildren the story of her life and traditions of memory work and self-awareness that she was raised with. The careful and deliberate process of shaping the consciousness of her grandchildren's generation, she knew would be hampered considerably by not being able to talk to them on a daily basis and raise them with the kind of intimate contact, care, and nurture that was central to her own growing up in the rural areas. Mogona's word for the way she was raised by her great-grandparents and her grandparents was belonging. Quite the opposite of the calculated ethos conveyed by apartheid law, state, and society, which really rested on the idea that Black women did not belong. The girlhood experienced by women in the 1920s and 1930s South Africa was shaped far more by principles, ethics, and values instilled by parents, extended family members, and communities than by the structure of apartheid. Partly because this generation of women grew up in a period in which their extended families were landed peasants who drew on adult female and children's labor to secure economic self-sufficiency and came into their adolescence as witnesses to the transition to being less economically autonomous, more insecure, and more dependent on the wage economy. Their memories of their childhoods are more coherent and perhaps provided the measure against which they organized politically against economic misery. Brooks explains, as the worsening economic conditions of the 1930s continued to plague Black farming families, rural daughters were forced to leave the farms for more lucrative, but often incredibly low-wage employment in the cities. Despite a surrounding structure of white supremacy, these communities still had the capacity to train their own artisanal class, to provide effective social and moral education, to delay child rearing and marriage while cultivating sexual awareness and autonomous gender identities. They were able to raise their children with an enviable freedom from want. Under apartheid, Black people were constantly met with the message that they were unwanted, they were discarded, while paradoxically, they were exactly the human resource through which apartheid extracted surplus, wealth, and white human value. Just as Mogona's To My Children's Children renders a life story about inherited self-sufficiency and the suffering associated with not being able to pass that status on to the next generation, in Jugulo Ndebele's The Cry of Winnie Mandela deploys the character Manette to describe the transition from a young woman's protected girlhood to a mature woman's having had to support her children without her husband's emotional or financial support. Ndebele's Manette explains both the dire situation she faced when she realized that her husband was not going to be able to contribute anything toward the care of herself and her children, and her sense of achievement at having figured out a way to generate an income from the informal economy to feed her children and other minors in her care, sending them to school and making sure that they had enough. As Manette described in a scene of a women's assembly, "Mosadi," I said to myself, "you have to be your own pillar. My children and I, we became a little army of survival. God blessed all five of my children with intelligence, and I only needed to put a patch of clothing on their backs and a bit of food in their hands, and they took themselves through school and university." End quote. The tension is one best explained by someone who appreciates the material value and social worth that white capital extracted from Black women, as well as Black women's testimonies of how the material success of the nation and their own children resulted decisively from their decisions about how and where and why to educate their children. Going further, Manette boasted, "Look at me now. My children are big and they are working. All except one are married, and all except one have left me." Hey, speaking to Winnie Mandela, "your country has swallowed them up as it swallowed their father, who was a minor. They And children of other mothers come to you now, not as minors, but as bankers, civil servants, chief executive officers, lawyers, doctors, and professors. Pamela Brooks explains this period of the 1920s and 1930s girlhood as obtaining prosperity accomplished by a help and cooperation of relatives, neighbors, and friends, an understanding of mutual obligation and reciprocity. The people that she interviews talk about having a pride of heritage and having specific people in their lives from the earlier generation that gave them a pride of place and a pride of principle. These were young people in the 1920s and 1930s, both in South Africa and also in Black Belt, Alabama, who worked collectively with their families to maintain something like self-sufficiency until people really were driven into the wage economy. It's so interesting to sort of read these oral histories of these women, because they talk about being so mad at their mothers when they were children, because their mothers would sort of stand over them to make sure that they knew how to press clothes very, very well, or sew very, very well, or bake or clean very, very well. But they were trying to prepare them for autonomy and for self-sufficiency and not having to depend on anyone else. And it's actually because these women they describe in these oral histories, because they knew how to do these kinds of things, they always had a means of self-support. No matter what was, wherever they were, they could always work for themselves because they knew how to do these things. Brooks demonstrates that the continuity of this intergenerational ethics called forth and ingrained the organizing and mobilizing capacities to break apartheid bureaucracy by producing bold, resistant social subjects. That means something like raising our daughters and sons to have a sense of their own dignity. Yeah. While honestly portraying the harsh conditions of migration to the townships, Sindiwe Bagona's To My Children's Children also characterizes the mesmerizing experience of proximity to city life and opportunity, the seeming attainability and the constant reminder that Black life, not just Black labor, was taken for cheap. From her church-going mother's smooth evasion of police during liquor raids, to her mother's work outside the home, to her mother's aspiration to defy the law in order to supplement her husband's desperately meager income, to her parents' willingness to sacrifice to educate both the narrator and her brother, to descriptions of her fellow domestics. She has this lovely scene where she talks about all of the domestic workers. She says, none of the domestics, no matter what kind of cast-off junk would be given by their madams, none of them would be stupid enough to turn anything down. Because there was an elaborate sharing in the townships. If you got comic books or old clothes or sweaters or nightgowns, you would distribute them to other people. That was part of those survival strategies that people used. Okay. I'm going to have to skip the section on militant motherhood, but you'll have to go back to Indibela's work to see it worked out. The next section is called Particular Vulnerabilities. The particular vulnerabilities of Black South African women included criminalization. I said that a couple of times, and I'm going to tell you what I mean by that. Criminalization, police harassment and violence, and revolving cycles of exclusion from housing, and the potential for wealth accumulation, and the qualities of social capital that can sometimes accrue from home ownership, tenancy, squatting, or even just some kind of enforceable right to belong in the city. For those who have been literally dispossessed, housing, and this I'm sort of thinking about our own experiences with 2008, for those who have been literally dispossessed, housing secures a bulwark against dispossession and being treated as movable property. Never settled, always available to be disrupted, injured, and evicted. In other words, housing, whether public or private, has a particular political resonance for Black people because having secure shelter distinguishes Black people from that stigmatized marker of Blackness being chattel or movable property. Those African women who could establish and secure residency in the urban areas through a male relative's employment and or through their own employment constituted an important social force because they could hold on to their place in the city. The meanings which they attached to work, community, resources, religious and political organizations, pooling household resources, family security, provide important indicators for analyzing the impact of forced migration schemes. The next section is called the Anti-Pass Law Campaigns, the Native Land Act, and previews of the Section 10 laws. This is my last section and then the conclusion. As early as the 1890s, South African provinces began to introduce pass laws, which was a passport-like document that was used by the state to surveil, track, record, and restrict Black movement. Passes, now get this, you have to have a pass, right? And there's fees associated with it, and you have to pay those fees sometimes weekly or monthly, right, to do anything like participate in the informal economy or just to move from one part of the country to the next. That takes a lot of them. You know, you've got to really be thinking how to nickel and dime people like that. That's real wicked. Mm-hmm. Passes and the fees associated with renewing them on a weekly or monthly or daily basis were deployed to bar Black women from participation in every single arena of the informal economy which they entered, from manufacture of beer to the laundry trade to the sale of agricultural products. And unsurprisingly, Black women, having seen their husbands harmed by pass law and having to carry passes, immediately rejected the imposition of passes. Historian Nomonisa Gasa reinterprets notions about Black women's anti-pass law resistance by focusing on militant revolts against the imposition of passes that began as early as the 1890s. Gasa finds in the rural area of Bloemfontein, which we imagine to be sort of like an all-white Afrikaner province, you know, maybe like, I don't know, southern Ohio, right? There's actually all these other kind of people living there, right? So Bloemfontein is, understood as being this completely white place, but it was never a completely white place, right? But it was definitely white in the sense that the non-white people, you knew you were non-white because you were a person that they were skimming money from for the benefit of whoever was designated as white. So Gasa finds that the Bloemfontein anti-pass protests were multi-class, multi-ethnic, meaning across the different African groups, and also meaning both quote-unquote colored and African, because at that time period, even though the state was trying to impose the colored identity, Black women refused that identity. They would more often refer to each other in their writings and pamphlets about these protests as working women. Right, they didn't refer to themselves as Zulu, or they just didn't. So these protests were multi-class, multi-ethnic, militant, and drew on a wide range of political strategies, from collecting thousands of petitions to delegations to city and national representatives and ministers, to protest marches, to public pass burnings. So what would typically happen is maybe 20 women would decide in a small rural town that they were going to burn their passes. And when the police came, another 300 women would join them. Oh, so they would just do a jailing. They would say, okay, you want to arrest it, you have to arrest everybody, and they wouldn't give the names up of whomever. Right. And this happened over and over and over again as early as the 1890s and became more intense by the 1913-1910 period. Calling the earliest anti-pass struggles primarily middle class, Christian, African, and not colored, as most of South African historiography has done, caricatures the effectiveness and persistence and resonance of this campaign. Additionally, though national organizations were developed as a result of these protests, what is perhaps more significant is that these African and colored women resisted in a way that launched multi-generational rolling strikes against passes across wide swaths of the South African countryside. And so you find this in descriptions of contemporary rural revolts that happened in Mpondo and all kinds of places around South Africa. When you talk to young people about why they participated in an activity, it's sort of an interesting way of talking about history. They talk about their grandparents' experience of protest as if it's their own, right? Or having heard about it's deep, right? Mm-hmm. So if you tell the stories to the younger generation about what kinds of things you fought against, it will impress upon them that you expect them to fight back, mm-hmm. and that they have the capacity to fight back. Mm-hmm. But you do have to tell them, right? Yeah, we don't always tell each other what we've done to survive. By 1913, there were 13 different types of very expensive permits and passes imposed upon black women that were being used to extort them and create an extra taxation and funding stream for local government that would never benefit them. These passes include some of the names: stand permits, residential passes, visitors passes, seeking work passes, employment registration certificates, permits to reside on employers' premises, and entertainment permits. As Sindiwe Mugona explained, the law, the greatest hardship we labored under was not that we had no protection from the law. No, that was the lesser evil. The worst was that we were burdened with protection by the master class, by an unwieldy plethora of laws, bylaws, rules, and regulations passed by a parliament with whose existence we had nothing to do and whose raison d'etre appeared to be our exclusive protection. Heavy indeed was the yoke that black people bore, thus protected by the white man who had set himself up as their god, end quote. You know, sometimes I hear us talk about, like, stop talking about the white man. Like, that's the old history. Stop talking about it. And this real, like, post-racial argument that somehow we're in a different moment, you know, and, like, everything's all juicy and fine and nobody's hungry and everybody has what they need and all of our kids have laptops and heat in the house. And we all know that's not true. Anyway, their livelihood strategies and precarious role as workers was not merely undermined by the often female gender typing of their employment categories and what they did for work. Rather, their livelihood strategies and precarious roles as workers was most profoundly undermined by being viewed as laborers who belong to, in the sense of being human possessions, the larger white community. And remember, in the 1920s and 1930s, who was white in South Africa was still being made, right? A lot of people who today would be designated as white wouldn't have been designated as white then. So it's complicated. So first you had these anti-pass campaigns, right? Then the second big issue was the Native Land Act. Native Land Act in 1913 removed 90% of black people and restricted them to living on less than 7% of the land surface in South Africa. What that means is that people are forced to go into wage employment. What that means is that people who maybe could have been sharecroppers because they had cattle and so they could go and share their land, they could exchange work to be able to graze their cattle, wouldn't be able to feed their cattle, wouldn't have land, really basically outlawed anything like black independent economic life. I'm at 42 minutes, so I'm going to try to wrap myself up here. Those of you who think about doing some international work, May we all always be humble enough to read the history of poor people, of the places where we want to work. And those of us who are going to do work in communities that are not our own, may we always start by reading what poor people have said they have done to survive before we try to sit down and come to some solidarity. So here's my conclusion. In the main, the reasons why it is quite easy to erase the history of women's political militancy in post-apartheid South African politics has to do with the construction of rural spaces as backward and antagonistic to political and economic mobilization. And unfortunately, because the way that the Truth and Reconciliation Project was worked out politically, people were told to forgive and forget the traumatized past. You know, like, just stop talking about it. Because, you know, it's in the past. You make a new nation. It's sort of like the, you know, reconstruction year. Like, it's, we're new. It's all new, right? It's a new moment, right? Yes and no. Everything is given credit for women's capacity to subvert the strictures of migrant, rural, city dweller identities and class identities. Being able to subvert the strictures of competing religious affiliation, accept their own long history of militant local political organizing that relied heavily on the diligent training of young women by their mothers and fathers. Somehow the quotidian practices of intergenerational political consciousness raising, women's religious assemblies, and the creativity of mothers to make do and a system designed to undermine their dignity are reduced to artifacts instead of the most valuable set of variables to explain the contemporary exercise of collective action and grassroots power. Scholarly history literally engenders by designating some acts minor, unremarkable, not noteworthy, silent, or absent. And those acts somehow always get seen as the things that women did, whereas on the other hand, those acts which are public and coordinated and strategic and rational and vigorous somehow are the acts of men. So when historian Nombonisa Gasa offers us the idea that women's struggles are best understood as an ongoing journey along a continuum textured by historical interruption, but continuing nonetheless, she's offering us a really powerful way of thinking about what women have done and contributed in history. And what it ultimately means is that historical writing and paradigms themselves often dispossess and disappear and distract us from the full-blown and totally elaborated lives of that group which locates itself within the social relations of African womanhood. So I ask you to tell me about your mothers, their survival strategies, their missteps, and the lives they lived. Tell me about the women who claimed you as the inheritors of their institutional memories, who spent time telling you about the things that they had suffered, who insisted that you belong to them, who imagined you generations before you actually were born, and who made sure that you were fed or put in the hands of others who could feed you. Thank you. Thank you.